Your story is waiting for you today. Your story has something new to say. But your story will only come out to play when you're alone. Alone. Alone in a room with invisible people.
The following episode may contain swearing. Alone in a Room with Invisible People is brought to you by hollyswritingclasses.com. Hi, I'm Rebecca Gallardo, and I'm the host of Alone in a Room with Invisible People. I'm here with author and teacher Holly Lyle, and today's topic is getting unstuck. But before we get into the topic, let's talk about what we did this week. And I'll go first since mine is little and yours is bigger once again. this week, even though I was really super busy with other stuff, I definitely sat down and I made myself write, and I've got a new schedule. So now every Monday through Thursday, I write from 10 to 12, and I've been working with you. And I finished a whole other ghost story for the anthology, and that is my priority right now, to get that done for October. So that is what I am doing now, and then in October I plan on writing the second Leaving Wanda Lucia book. So I got one entire other story done. It was over 3,000 words. And then I also got a lot of, two or three extra stories for the anthology. I don't know how big this freaking thing's going to be now.
Cool.
Yeah, I got two or three extra story ideas. And I started the How to Write a Novel course. I just started with the first exercise, and I answered some questions, I think like one or two, but the first exercise gave me something freaking amazing.
Cool.
I was writing it down, and I can tell that this is something that my muse loves, because if this item that you're supposed to describe and stuff is in a movie, I always get very excited, because I love that mystery of this item, like what's in it, you know, what was it made of, who made it, and just the idea that popped into my head is like, oh, I finally get to tell it right. I finally get to tell it my way. I get to make it my mystery, which was really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that was my writing week.
Okay, well, mine started with finishing the first lesson of How to Write a Novel and getting that up live. Oh my God. Because the rest of my week was, or a certain amount of my week was exploded by the How to Write a Novel class when Becca and I were both working the site and help desk, and so many people hit the page simultaneously that it didn't break the payment process, but it did break the automatized system that put people into class, which meant that Becca and I were crazy putting people into their classes and making sure everybody had their stuff. And the following day I went through and found every single receipt for every single person whose account was affected and sent them an individual email.
And that took you forever.
Oh my God, that took a long time. But in spite of that, the first few days of the week I got my stuff on the owner's tale written. And yesterday I made up my 2 hours of writing that I missed on Thursday and Friday, because I did not write any fiction on Thursday or Friday. I barely breathed. But I caught up yesterday and I got the best stuff. I got about 1,500 words keepable.
Nice.
And it was all on the owner, but I got this awesome twist with Shay and Shay and Melly, which is the other main story that's going on here, and figured out a way to interlace that with the owner's story. And I am just so excited.
Yeah, I love that kind of thing when that happens. And sometimes it's just you pull stuff out of nowhere and everything just starts linking stuff up. And I know that we've talked about this before, and we will have to do an episode on the muse Yes. Just in general, because there's also cons of the muse.
Oh my God. Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll have to, I'm writing that down right now. We'll have to definitely do an episode on the muse. But yeah, when your brain starts pulling things out of your story that you didn't even remember you put in there, and you go back on read back, or you realize when it fixes something and it makes it deeper and it makes it more conflicty, and it's just amazing.
I love that. I really do. It's one of the really fun parts of the job is having the story just start clicking for you.
And yeah. So actually that's exactly the opposite of today's
podcast
or episode. I didn't even think about that, but that's an excellent segue, is how to get there, you know, like how to get unstuck.
Yeah.
So you can freaking get to the flow. So the problem with getting stuck sometimes, there's something has gone wrong with the story. That much I know.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there's something where you are either bored with it, or you can't think of where to go next, or you sit down and you have written yourself into a corner,
mm-hmm.
or the characters won't speak to you anymore. You know, whatever it is for different writers.
Right. And so it's your muse knows something is wrong, but it can't quite tell you something is wrong, so it just stops.
So how do there, if with so many different problems and options and everything, can you let us know what are the problems, and then how can we decipher them?
Yeah.
How can we dig them out and find out what the problem is?
Yeah. Well, this, again, this goes back to things that we have discussed in previous episodes, where you are looking at your protagonist, your antagonist, your conflict, your setting, your twist, and then the additional things, your story idea, your theme, and your subtext. But you have to go through these one at a time and ask yourself you have to ask yourself questions. So the first thing you look at is your protagonist. And there are a lot of things that can go wrong with a protagonist. And your muse will sometimes recognize them, and sometimes it will just know that there's something wrong and it'll stop. But I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example here of a protagonist that just quit on me. And it's been a while since I have had that happen. But
I've had a few. Actually, with Leaving Wanda Lucia, I was writing not Kaylee, because Kaylee was pretty well developed. I was writing Dom,
mm-hmm.
and he was just flat, you know, and I feel like I could have done a little bit better of a job with characterization for him. And I feel like if it sells or if it doesn't sell, it's giving me an opportunity to actually kind of build him out a little bit more, flesh him out. But I remember he would get on the page, and after the first couple of scenes, I didn't know where to go with him, even though I had everything written down and a little bit of his history. He was just there, but I didn't, I didn't know how he would talk. I didn't know how he would respond to things.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I hadn't done enough of a character biography for him. So I personally just dug out, create a character, and just kind of flipped through, found a random page, and picked one, like, without looking.
Right.
And then scrolled down until I found where I had actually picked. And then I started into that, just kind of just answering that question.
Right.
And it led me to an entire day of working on Dom.
Yeah. That is basically the way you do it. If you figure out the protagonist that is the problem, or if you figure out that the protagonist is the problem, then you go through and you ask yourself essential questions like, what does this character need to be doing? Or why is this character doing what he's doing right now, which doesn't seem to fit him? Or what could he do that would be so much cooler than what he's doing now? And there are a ton of questions, and they are based on the character, what's important to the character, and what matters to him, what he fears, what he loves, what he needs.
There's a lot of those questions in create a character clinic. Mm-hmm. But there was one I saw recently in one of the courses. Maybe it was the how to write short stories. It was what secret do they have?
Yeah.
Which I thought was really neat. But
yeah.
How, before we get to the different individual questions between the protagonist and antagonist, like mm-hmm. what is my problem? How do people find out what their problem is? What kind of clues are they looking for to know this? It's a protagonist problem. It's I have no arc for conflict or what? How do people find out?
Okay, well, the easier things to look for first, and the things that you test first because they're also easier to fix, are you look for, you read your protagonist, and you have to read through your story, and sometimes you're going to have to read through it a couple of times, and it helps a lot if you print it out on paper, because you will miss things on the screen. Your brain does not treat the screen the same way it treats a page, a piece of paper, and you will miss important details. So you print out whatever you've got on your manuscript, and you go through and you look for the protagonist. You look for the antagonist. You look at the villain. You look at what the villain is doing. You read to see if there's a conflict. And a conflict is, again, not people arguing with each other. A conflict is the obstacle that the characters must overcome to achieve what they want to achieve. And so frequently the problem is that there is no conflict. You'll have people who are sitting around thinking about what they might do or thinking about what they did. Another thing, if your protagonist is unlikable, if you have the person that you are presenting as the hero to the character is someone who is a scumbag, that's going to be a problem, and that can stall your muse, because what you are doing is telling your muse, this is the person that I want to make as the ideal for this book. And then everybody else is, you know, not that guy. This is the one that I want my readers to love. And if the character sucks, why would your readers love him? Setting is so frequently overlooked. If you're reading along and you realize that you have the dreaded talking heads in space where there's no sense of place, there's no sense of time, there is no people sitting around doing things. I in one class that I put together, I had a man and a woman who were talking about a horse that she wanted to buy and he didn't because he was sleeping with the current owner of the horse. Anyway, in the first thing, it was just two people talking back and forth and there was nothing to it. In the second scene, he is sitting on a bale of hay, mending a piece of saddle with the tools that you use to mend a saddle. And she is leaning on the frame of the stall. And the two of them, they're in the barn, they are working, he is working, she has stopped working in order to discuss this thing with him. And it just that change, just having the place where this happens changed everything. And it was at the point where I had the place and I had what he was doing that I suddenly realized that the reason that he didn't want to buy the horse was because he was sleeping with the woman who already owned it. And setting and things like that will give you more story.
Okay, so that's something else to look at, to where, and it sounds like with these, when you figure out what's gotten you stuck, that you don't even have to go back and change everything and toss everything. You can just look at each scene individually and say, okay, well, how can I include this? Or how can I make this particular scene better? What element do I need in this scene?
Right.
And the conflict one was really important because you mentioned that. And I just want to say, like, a lot of people think that, especially if they read some of your stuff and they see candy bar scenes. Okay, well, they think those are the scenes that are really fun to write. And they are. They're the ones that you are motivated to get to. But the rest of the scenes still have to have all of the important stuff.
Yes.
They still have to have, you know, what you call packs, the protagonist, antagonist, conflict, setting, and twist.
Right.
And I know that good scenes have all of those, and each scene has to be looked at as a full compartmentalized thing.
Right, right. Every scene has to have all the parts. And Twist is the one that I think of the ones that are easiest to fix, the PACTS, P-A-C-T-S, or Protagonist, Antagonist, Conflict Setting, Twist. Twist is the one that is hardest to get right unless you ask yourself the following question. Why am I writing this scene? And if you ask, you know, why is this scene in the story? Why does this scene have to be in the story? And if you can't think of a reason, the problem is the twist. If you can think, well, this is the scene where Betsy discovers that she has fallen in love with Bob. And at the same time, he decides that he needs to get as far away from her as he can. That's a twist. That it isn't. Not every twist is a cliffhanger. Not every twist is a surprise ending. The twist is the change that happens in the scene that makes you want to write the scene in the first place. And if you don't have one of those, you don't have a scene. Same with setting, same with conflict, which is the obstacle that must be either suffered through or overcome. And my characters, a lot of times they do not overcome the obstacle, they just get clobbered by it more ferociously. And that counts too.
So anything can be a twist, really, as long as it has to do with the plot. So a character going out and, oh, they got mail today, they got a letter, that can be a twist because it changed things. The letter can be something. So it doesn't have to be this huge surprise thing. It doesn't have to be this huge moment where everything in the book changes. It is just something that changes.
Exactly. But it does have to be meaningful.
Yes. Something that changes according to the plot.
If they go out and they get a letter, the letter needs to be from the IRS or something. It's like,
Can be just, you know, from somebody saying somebody died or
right, or
somebody's kid got expelled, whatever fits your plot. But
right,
that scene, if it's included in the book, it has to have an effect.
Right, right. It has to be there for a reason. But these, okay, so you go through and you look for each scene. And a lot of people don't know when they've written a scene. This is one of the things that How to Write Page-Turning Scenes, I went through and walked people through that, because having somebody sitting in a room thinking about something, or going through the what we call in nursing the ADLs, the activities of daily living, you know, getting up, making your bed, brushing your teeth, going to the bathroom, taking a shower, going out, fixing breakfast, eating breakfast, not only is that not a scene, that whole activities of daily living thing, but that will make people ditch your story so fast, because that the minutia of life is not what fiction is about. Fiction is about creating an appearance of life, but just the good parts. It's life, the good parts version. All the scary stuff and all the exciting stuff and all the passionate stuff and all the things that change you for the worse or change you for the better or make you want to be the person in the story. If you've just got somebody who gets up, rolls out of bed, makes the bed, brushes her teeth, and that is not a scene. So one of the things that you have to do is discover whether you have actually written a scene. And you have to do that all the way through the story. But again, these are the easier things to fix. These are structural. These are technical. These allow you to look at them and diagnose easily. The other stuff is a little bit tough.
So my question is, we know, okay, so if we're reading through our book and some of the scenes fall flat, or you realize, okay, well, there's no point to this scene, or these people, like if I came in, like if my scenes are running too long, okay, I can get rid of all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the brushing the teeth.
Yes.
And now this isn't a conversation on how to write a scene, so we can't get too much into that. But that can be another problem where you're getting stuck, I guess, is the boredom and the minutia that you're including in the writing is boring your muse to into a coma.
Yes.
So
yes, muses will go on strike.
So when you are looking at basically the scene problem, I guess would also be conflict. It could be setting. It could be twist.
Mm-hmm.
With the protagonist, you're saying that it has to be somebody that fits the genre of your book. So if it's a romance, don't make him a douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that would be kind of in general, try not to make him a douchebag.
Right. I mean, there are exceptions to the rule. And one of the things that I have discovered is that no matter how far you miss the boat, if you are telling an interesting story, people will read awful characters. But there is a reader for just about everything. That what you want to do is make sure that you find your readers. So if
that's what I meant. Like, don't write him to be a douchebag to you.
Right, right. He has to be someone. If you're writing someone who is your hero, then you make him someone you would like. You don't make him someone that you think. Oh God, help us! Don't make him fucking edgy. Okay, with wherein. You are saying, okay, well, I am going to make him the opposite of everything that everybody likes because that's edgy. No, that's just annoying. Don't do that.
There's a lot of books that I've picked up recently that you can tell somebody is trying to make the character complex and deep, so he's an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an asshole all the time. He doesn't have good convictions. It's like that's, and they're trying to say, oh, he's angsty.
No.
I guess this kind of comes from that Edward and Bella thing.
Yeah.
But it's not, there has to be a depth to the character. Create the reasons why he's an asshole. Give him solid moments of being a genuine person.
Right.
Genuine goodness.
Right. We have to see that he is not a flat, one-dimensional paper person. Paper people suck. You want to let us understand.
I want that to be a shirt.
Paper people suck.
Yeah.
You want to allow us to understand why he's the hero of the book. And so we have to, there is this phrase, save the cat. If you have somebody who's going to come in and in the first third of the book, we are going to see mostly that he's an asshole, that he's not a great guy, then in just right at the very start, you have to have him save the cat. Okay, you have to have him do some small, irrelevant, good thing that lets us know that, okay, somewhere inside this person that you are writing as all tough and mean and angsty, there is this person who will do something good, not because it's going to make him money, not because he is a psychopath who's using it to manipulate people, but because there is some good in him. And we need to see that if you want to write a dark, angsty character who will eventually prove himself to be good. So say,
yeah, I had a character in a screenplay, and I didn't think about this because this was years ago. And he was the antagonist. He was walking into a building, and there was this little old lady, like, you know, 80, 90 years old, bent over, hunched over, small with a cane, tiny, withered. And she had grocery bags, and he didn't open the door for her. He opened the door, walked right through. The door kind of was closing, and there was lots of people. So he gets to the elevator. He doesn't hold the elevator for her. They go up to the floor, and she gets off on his floor, and he sighs because he has to hold the elevator because she's getting out first. And he's waiting and waiting. And when she leaves, her paper bag explodes. The bottom of it comes out. And the moment for me as the writer was I got that feeling inside of him. And this is one of the cooler things of writing is you are the other person. So while it might not have shown up on screen because this is a screenplay, not a novel, there was this moment of sympathy. It wasn't just pity. It was sympathy,
mm-hmm.
which was interesting. It was like, why does he know how that feels?
Right.
You know, and why is he so sad for her? So he helped her and everything. He was still gruff and he was still grumpy. And it just, was a small, tiny moment in him being a dick, because you were absolutely certain he was just going to walk on by and let that little old lady clean up her own shit.
Yeah.
But it ended up being that this was going to end up as one of the love interests.
And that was the moment when he came to life for you, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because originally he wasn't, he got his own subplot in the entire film. And it was, it's kind of like this grouping of love stories. But it opened my eyes and it made that character so much deeper. And it was just a stupid, simple thing. You think, okay, well, that's what everybody does. Well, everybody's supposed to hold the door. Everybody's supposed to hold the elevator if there's room. Everybody's supposed to let old people go first. Uh-huh. You know what I mean?
Right.
If he's already proven he doesn't do what everybody does.
Then there is a question to, okay, well, he isn't a complete jerk, so why was he acting like a jerk? And then what was it that made him stop being a jerk at this one moment? Yeah, that is absolutely a save the cat moment right there.
Yeah, and it's something tiny. That's why I brought it up, because it doesn't have to be, you know, jumping into a burning building to save a nice little kitty cat.
No, really, it can be a very small thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and my thing doesn't make my guy a hero right away. It just makes him not 100% a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I had one of my villains redeem himself at the end when he pretty much had the hero and the heroine in his sights. And then his daughter, who he has kept secret from everybody forever, you know, that she was the one good thing in his life, was in danger, and she was going to die if he went after the hero and the heroine. So he went back and saved her, which caused him to die instead, but he had saved her. And that was
awesome.
Yeah, and that was
sad but
yeah, but it was, he had been a pretty bad villain all the way through the thing. I mean, he wasn't the big guy, but he was, you know, like second in command. And at that moment, he made his choice that he was going to save what mattered to him, then destroy the thing that he had been determined to destroy. And, you know, it cost him his life. And he knew it was going to cost him his life when he did it, and he did it anyway.
Man, that's pretty powerful. Is that secret text?
Yeah.
All right, so let's say you've looked through, you've got your protagonist, antagonist, conflict, twist, setting, all of those are, you know, pretty okay. You feel strong with your characters and you think you've got good conflict and your settings are popping out and you think you've got all of these little twists to most of the scenes or something. What, if you're still stalling out, what could possibly be the problem? How do you get unstuck if you can't find the problem within PAX?
Okay. These are tougher to fix. These are significantly tougher to fix, and they frequently require you to rethink your story. The first is the problem actually with my story idea? And one of the things that we are struggling with that we are going through right now in how to write a novel is your story idea big enough for the story you want to tell? If you are stalling out at 5,000 words and you have looked at your protagonist, your antagonist, conflict setting, and twist are all good, and you still can't figure out what's wrong because you're stuck and you're staring at the page and you can't think of what happens next, it is very, very likely that you don't have a big enough story for the piece of work that you are trying to build. It should be obvious, but frequently isn't, that an idea that is sufficient for a 500-word story is not sufficient for a 200,000-word story. And people will go into a story planning to write a novel with an idea that will only hold up 2,000 or 3,000 words, simply because a novel idea is different than a short story idea, which is different than a flash fiction idea, and all of those are different than series ideas. These are all different kinds of writing. And
This is, yeah, this is kind of like my problem with the Hulk, right? So like if you watch the 70s version, it's more the physical difference between David Bannister, I think that's his name, and
Matthew Banner?
Banner, David Banner. Yeah. Oh, Bannister is from The Frighteners. All right, so okay. The Hulk.
Yeah.
So the difference between the man and the beast in the 70s is not quite so much. There's not just this huge leap, but when it comes to all of the other versions of him where he just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and some of the clothes still fit and all this nonsense, it bothers me because it's a physics, it's a science thing, especially for how smart he's supposed to be. I'm sorry if you can hear my cat. Especially with how smart he's supposed to be. He's supposed to be the scientist and everything. Well, the thing with that is it's not possible. There's not enough skin, flesh, bone, fabric to expand like that,
mm-hmm.
to create this mass that is what nowadays like 20 times as big as right. him, if not more.
Right.
So it's the same concept. Is there's not enough flesh on the bones, there's not enough material, you know, like mm-hmm. fabric, flesh, guts.
That's a nice analogy.
Yeah, that's just yeah.
Your book is not the Hulk.
Yeah. Yeah, or your story idea is not the Hulk, and you need to bulk it up if
yeah, and you have to bulk it up with muscle and not just padding.
Yeah. That's... So okay, so let's take story idea first.
Okay.
How would you fix it if that is the problem?
Oh, okay. Well,
okay, how would you diagnose it?
Okay.
And then how would you fix it?
You diagnose by going, "Okay, am I able to write down 15 or 20 potential scenes in which something important changes?" And if the answer to that is yes, okay, your idea is big enough. That's not a problem. If it's like, oh my God, I just don't know what could happen next, I am out of ideas. Okay, bingo. That's the problem right there. If you are out of ideas of what could happen next, your story idea is too small. And if you want to write a novel, you can, that is the first lesson that we're working on right now, is how to come up with ideas. And people are so excited too. Yeah, it's really cool. I've been reading stuff on their posts on the forum, and it's just neat what they've come up with and how they're using it. Anyway, to get back on track. So
yeah, if the story idea is the problem,
right?
If you can't come up with enough scenes to support your story idea, then you have to expand the story idea.
Right. That's it. And you do that by asking yourself questions like, what else can matter? Who else is in the story? A novel is not two characters and one setting. A novel is the protagonist and the antagonist. And then it's also friends or love interests or secondary characters. It is multiple settings. It takes place over a longer period of time. It's bigger in every way, but it's not just longer. It's not just more words. And one of the things that people really run into trouble with is that they think, okay, if I have 50,000 words on a page, I have written a novel. Not necessarily. If you have told a novel story, if you have told a story that has these different parts, these sub-stories with different conflicts that interrelate with the main conflict, that is a novel. If you have multiple smaller story endings and then the big story ending at the end that wraps everything up, that's a novel. If you are just trying to make a bunch of words hold together on a small idea, that is a short story that needs to be trimmed back drastically.
Okay. So just again, it always comes back to the same thing. If this is your problem, ask good questions related to the problem. And it could take you 30 minutes, it could take you 5 minutes, it could take you 2 days of asking yourself different questions related to the novel, related to the story idea, like how else can I expand this? What other characters are there? Where else could this go bad? What if I expanded this into two different states? What if two other people were having the same problem, et cetera, et cetera? So it could just, whatever question sparks that interest. So after story idea, is there any other big problems that are harder to solve?
Yes. The next big problem is theme. And most people don't even consider a theme. But if you are writing fiction, you generally have a theme in your gut. There is something in the story that you want to say. And if there is, that's really good. And if you can identify it, that's even better. One of the things that I loved in Leaving Wanda Lucia, which is Becky's book, is that you had some of your big passions in that story. Animal Rescue it's a romance novel, but it's a really good romance novel. And part of it is about one of the characters' passions for rescuing animals. Another one is about a person who has been abused and who is on the run. And these are things that, you know, really matter to you. And I know they matter to you. And finding your own independence and trying to create a life for yourself that's the life that you want to live. That's some fairly deep stuff. And to find that in a romance novel made it much deeper and more fun to read than just, they have a misunderstanding, and he thinks that she doesn't love him, and she thinks that he doesn't love her, and they both really love each other, and they could fix this by just taking 5 minutes to talk to each other. No, these were real problems. These were real problems with a scary stalker. And
the critiquer from hell told me, oh, well, romance has a formula, and this doesn't fit it. It doesn't work. They're supposed to think that they don't love each other until the end. And I'm like, yeah, that's...
No.
Not all romance does that. Okay. Right. Some romance does it really well. I'll give it that. But not all romance does it. And there were themes like, I had a theme of social media in there, both pro and con.
Yes.
I had the theme of, like you said, the abuse, and I tried to show different angles from it. And I think I didn't even recognize the themes until I was going through How to Revise Your Novel. And I started noticing what is important to you, even if you don't know what it is, it will start to come out on page. So I can say from personal experience, if the theme is, if you're looking through and you don't think you have a theme, just pay attention to the things that you get passionate about when you're writing on the page, because that can be expanded into a theme, which is what I ended up doing. I just took what I had already put in there and maybe added a little bit more, maybe try to make certain things more important, more poignant.
Yeah, you added a lot of depth. Yeah. But that is a beautiful piece of advice right there. If you are not writing about something about which you are passionate, you are almost certainly not including a theme in the story. And at the point where you don't have a theme, if you don't have something that really is important to you that you are including in the story as you write it, you will very frequently stall out and get stuck, because your muse has things to say. Your muse is your right brain. And your right brain doesn't have much of an outlet. It is nonverbal. It uses pictures, it uses images, it uses little hints and suggestions at the back of your mind. But it has a lot to say. And it is the part of you that is creative and spontaneous. And if this part of you is not having its say in your story, then it will, you know, go on strike. It will go sit in the corner and play with its toys in the dark in the back of your head. Until you realize that you've been running around in circles doing nothing because you're stuck.
So diagnosing a theme is it's harder to find, but it seems also like something that might stick out if you've written 20 scenes and you're reading them all.
Yeah, well,
and you're not passionate about anything that's in them necessarily.
Right. There is a question for this, which is, why do I give a shit about this book? And you had better be able to answer that question. And if you can't, you need to figure out what you can make a part of yourself. This is dancing naked on the rooftop, man. And it is the part of writing that is the most difficult, because you are bearing a part of your soul in your fiction. Now, you are disguising it if you're smart. You are making it happen to different people in different circumstances with different situations. But if you don't care about what you're writing, deeply care, deeply, passionately, oh my God, this is something I have tried my entire life to say passionately, you're not digging deep enough. Because a novel is a space for you to bring what matters to you to the fore, to make it something that other people can see and read and understand, and have it matter, or at least give you a chance to give them a chance to have it matter to them.
I think that's a really, really good way to put it too, because if you read, I've read a bunch of romances, and a lot of them are just people on a page having sex and then fighting and having sex and then fighting. And if you read them, it feels empty, even though the characters might be good. Mm-hmm. I've read books where the characters were great. I actually liked them. The settings were great. Like, I felt like I was there. There was the conflict, like it was done well enough. But it just didn't have that deeper meaning to where I actually cared.
Right.
You know, and then some of the romances are very, very simple. You can tell when somebody really, really cares about love or romance.
Right.
It's not just about, you know, trying to get another book out, trying to get another paycheck, trying to put another sex scene in. It's about how to portray these two characters that I want to get together.
Right.
Like, I am passionate about love and life and romance. It's the same with horror. If you are passionate about horror, it shows, because you're not just putting in jump scares. You're not just putting in blood, guts, and gore. You are trying to get to the basic psychology of different scary things, of what is terrifying.
Right.
And so it shows.
Right. It does. It shows. If this really matters to you, then that needs to be on the page. And if it's not on the page, you have to man up and take a deep breath and say, okay, well, yes, this is being naked on a rooftop. I will disguise it as best I can, but people are going to see what matters to me. And there will be some people who will judge me for that. Yep. Oh, well, they're not my readers.
Yep.
Move on. All right. The last one is subtext. And subtext is subtext is playing on a higher, slightly tougher level. Okay, this is not quite hard game mode, but it is trickier than playing on easy. When you are creating subtext, you have a thing in the real world about which you would like to complain, or which you would like to see fixed, or which you think you understand a fix for. And you,
or that you just want to get your opinion out on,
or that you just want to get your opinion out on, but you do
and make
not
a difference.
Yes. Yeah. And make a difference. But again, if you want to have a political opinion, go join a political party. If you want to send a message, write a sign. That's not what novels are for. So you take your message and you change it into, an allegory in which, okay, I'm going to give a little spoiler here. Vincalis the Agitator, which is the fourth book in the Secret Text trilogy. It's the prequel, and it was written last. And in Vincalis the Agitator, I jumped back 1,000 years to the society that had come before the society in which Kate and Rye live, they're the main characters of the Secret Text. And I wrote the story of Vincalis the Agitator, who was this poor kid from a caged community in this magnificent city. whose people were being used as fuel to feed the city that was living off of them. The energy of their lives was being channeled by magic into fueling this floating city, and this kid was immune to magic. He was the only one that had anyone ever knew of who was, he couldn't do magic, but he was completely immune to its effects. So he could see what was going on in this terrible enclosed community of people who were, they were fed, they were bred, they were given a sort of mindless entertainment, they were kept at a very low standard of living, and they were being used. And that, I came out with the action, with the truth about them when we were discussing subtext on my blog years ago, and said, well, yeah, that was an allegory for the welfare system. And as an RN back when I was working in the emergency room, I saw what being trapped on welfare did to people, and how hideous their lives were, because they were dependent on this amount of money that was coming in, and it looked like free money, but it kept them trapped in a system where they could not improve, where they could not get better things, because they were trapped in this system, and it was horrible. And you know, I had one young mother who came into the ER because her baby had a rash, and she was using trash bags as diapers because she couldn't afford diapers. And I cried, man. It was hideous. And you know, this was 30 years ago, but yeah you see.
I mean, you still, and this is not a political stance. This is not somebody saying, you know, that pro or anti anything necessarily, because there are always two sides to every story. There's always people who use
who
it
have
well
to have
and
help.
Abuse it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is just how to turn this story into something that you're passionate about in a subtexty way. And that's brilliant.
Yeah. And this is, you know, yes, these people were taken care of. Yes, they had food. Yes, they weren't starving. Yes, they had entertainment. Yes, they had housing. But they didn't have lives. They had no autonomy. They had no freedom to, you know, take the risks, because yeah, you know, if you're not protected, then there are always risks. But they didn't have this chance to build better lives for themselves. They had no upward path. And that was my allegory, was this community in this magical world, was this thing that just broke my heart. So that is subtext, and not all stories have subtext. But if you have something that really matters to you, you can't put it in as your diatribe on the abuses or the way the system, welfare system, damages individuals. Okay, you just, that's not a novel, that's a political statement. So you build this other thing, you build this allegory, and you walk away from your ability to control what people read into that. Because I had people who saw that as all kinds of different things, none of which were what I had intended, but that were meaningful to them. And when you create a subtext, and when you create this allegory, you release your control. You give up your ability to push your opinion, and you let people read into it what they need. And people will read into it things that you never intended in your life. But very often, because of your passion and your deep desire to say something and make it matter, and your ability to get this out of your system while keeping it hidden so that you weren't shoving it down people's throats, they will find something they need in your story.
Yeah, it's a common thing with art too. Is I was watching this art show maybe 5-6 years ago, and it was, there's a woman in it. Now, I didn't particularly like her art. I didn't think she was great, but that doesn't matter. What matters, she was a performance artist, and she was getting critiques, and everybody was telling her, you know, it was crap, we didn't understand it, blah blah blah. And she said something that, while I think they were right because I held the same opinion as them. What she said matters here too is I am not responsible for your experience of my art. It's somewhat the same.
Yes.
If you're looking at, you know, quality, obviously you are responsible. If you're looking at, you know, making sure dialogue is there, if you're making sure, if your responsibility is to put the very, very best work out that you possibly can, mm-hmm. work as hard as you can to get what you felt was important out. But you are not responsible for how somebody else interprets your work.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to be willing to let it go, but you will have a much deeper impact with your fiction if you can. If you don't feel like you have to push a point of view, if you are willing to say, okay, this is my allegory, and people are going to read into it what is important to them, and I have to be willing to let them do that. I have to bury my diatribe in a story that matters, and then just set it free and let it be whatever it is to the people who read it. And we have this interesting thread going on in How to Write Short Stories right now, where I had a bunch of different short stories that I wrote, and I showed people how to break down short stories by read them so that they could then understand how to build them. And the very first short story I did for the class that I put up for them was Armorella, which I have free on my website. You can just read the thing. And everybody went through and they broke it down. And they wrote down all of the different things that you have to know about it. And then they wrote what it meant. You know, the actual meaning of the story. There are about 57 different meanings for that one story. And people took completely different things away from it. And this is an education for writers right there. Because then they go back through. The assignment is, okay, you don't look at what anybody else has written. You write your thing. And then you go through and you read what other people have written. And they go through and they see what everybody else read and how everybody else came to different conclusions. And they go, oh my God, that's going to be me.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was eye-opening because I went through and I wrote down what I felt was absolutely obvious and correct. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like to me, that's what I got from it. And then I went through and I was thinking, okay, so there can't be that many different ideas, but holy crap.
So let's wrap up. We basically covered the different places where you can get stuck and how you can get stuck and why you're stuck. And then as quickly as we could, what you have to do to fix them. So basically what you're doing is as you build skills, you are making sure that you'll find out that getting unstuck gets easier. Because as you know more, you make fewer mistakes of the kind that you just made. But you also can spot mistakes that you have made if you make them again. And this is something that's kind of a big deal. Writers groups made up of objective readers of your work who are also writers can help brainstorm with you. They can help you look through your work. And it is very, very difficult to find a good writers group because so many writers groups have a couple of people who are destructive, as we described last week in the episode on destructive criticism.
Yeah, you've got people that think they're, you know, the best thing on the planet. You've got people with it's just writers groups are very, very difficult to get honed down because you've also got clashes with different personalities.
Yeah.
You've got people that want to talk about writing instead of actually writing. You've got people that, you know, are walking around offering to critique everybody's work because they're really good at finding
mistakes, but they don't actually write.
Yeah. Or, you know, you've got the guy who talks every 5 minutes because, you know, while he's trying to write, or it depends on if you're in there to write together or if you're in there to work with critiques. But yeah, it is really difficult to find a group where somebody isn't going in there trying to show everybody, doing the peeing contest, basically.
Right, exactly.
Trying, Yeah, trying to say, oh, well, I'm the best here. Let me tear everybody else down to prove it.
Right. So then what we've got here is I have a free online writers group. And if you are willing to be online with your writing, it is private. It is members only. It's free. It is for, and people go in and they make their own little groups of people who are interested in the same kinds of fiction they are, and they follow the rules of the site, which are very strict. There are absolutes in what you absolutely cannot say to somebody else, one of which is you're an idiot and you don't know how to write. So people
but
it, are
even
kind.
Even more subtle than that. You've got, and you have mods that are on stuff like, like crazy, like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's anything that's even slightly inappropriate or something like that, the mods will come in and take care of the issue.
Right.
So there's a lot of fear that you might have going into sharing your work, but Holly's forums are the most, it is a supportive community.
Yes.
Of other people that also, they want to succeed. They want to see you succeed. That they realize that not writers are not competitions, or other writers are not competition. They are just people doing the same job as you.
Right. We have built a culture, and it is a genuine community culture. There is a way folks do things, and one of the things they do is support each other's writing. And if this isn't something that you're used to, it can come as kind of a shock.
Yeah. Well, also, if you're going in there and you're looking to hear how great your stuff is,
don't do that.
Don't go into Holly's group, because they're kind, they're friendly, they're supportive as hell, but they won't hold back. If you're asking for critiques, they're going to give you their opinion. They're going to point out the things where you've gone wrong in their minds,
right,
or where you've just gone wrong.
But it is based on objectivity. It's not based on subjective, well, you know, I don't like romance, so I don't think you should write romance.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It's there are objective things like what Becky and I have discussed here that are specific to, you know, in a story and can be picked out by people who know how to look for it. And my guys know how to look for it.
And they're also really, really good basis for how to know what to look for in other writers in real life that you can create a group from. So if you go in there and you just kind of dip in your toes in and you get used to, you know, how certain people treat, don't think, oh, well, I won't find this in the real life. Yeah, it might be harder, but you can absolutely, you know, go to a bookstore, go to a library, put up a flyer, you know, ask permission, but usually they'll let you. And try to start your own group. Go to Facebook and create a page that you want to start doing meetups. You know, be safe about it. Don't be an idiot.
God, yes, but
yeah, but meet some people, talk to them, figure out what they like, and you can get a general idea. If some guy's sitting there saying, oh yeah, I read all the time, I can definitely point out flaws, blah blah blah, yeah, that's definitely not somebody you want for your group. No. But it's not all bad, and there are a lot of people out there that are like you and that want to write and that, you know, would love a writer's group. So this is a great way to teach yourself
what to expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. How to build
from
a writer's
group.
Yeah.
And so what's the takeaway for this episode?
All right. First, go back to what you have written and read all of it and identify the parts that work. Okay. If you have stuff that's in there that's good, make sure you save that. Okay, that's important. Then you ask questions to identify what doesn't work. So once you have protected the stuff that's good, you go through and you find the places where all of the things that we have discussed just either are missing or are broken or need some help. When you are done with that, you can either brainstorm by yourself, or it is very, very helpful to brainstorm with colleagues. It is so much easier to find somebody else's errors than to find your own, because you are deeply attached to your own words. You built them. They are your thing. And it is very hard to let go and look at them objectively. So being able to trade crits with folks who are doing this themselves, where you will help them find their errors gently, and they will help you find your errors gently, is huge. It's a massive thing for just making your life easier and helping you to move on. And finally, I have a ton of free articles and workshops on hollylyle.com. Just if you go to hollylyle.com/articles, and you will find, I think it's at this point over 100,000 words of how-tos and quick tips and frequently asked questions and little free workshops and step-by-steps and all kinds of stuff. I have been putting this stuff up there since, what, 1995?
Yeah, I was going to say, I know I was not even a teenager, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. When I started building this stuff, and there is a lot of it there. So, you know, just if budget is an obstacle, and I know for a lot of people it is, this is all free. It's not, you have to sign up for it. You don't even have to give an email address. You just go to hollylyle.com/articles.
The flash fiction course too.
Oh.
It's also free.
Yeah.
You do have to sign up, because then, you know, you can use the forum and they have to create an account so you have the flash fiction.
Right,
because
it's in a classroom.
Again, yeah, the flash fiction course can teach you a lot of stuff that we're talking about, because this is about getting unstuck. And I actually just suggested this to a friend of ours that was stuck on her writing and wanted to get stuck or get unstuck. And I, you know, it's different for every writer, but I told her, I'm like, go take the flash fiction course. I mean, it has everything in it. It can get your juices flowing. You can kind of create a little flash fiction story for your story. That, you know, it might be side characters. It might be just the same world that these people interact with. It's just a neat way to get another depth, a level of depth into your story that wasn't there before. And you don't ever have to include it. Maybe you can even include just a portion of it, but it's something else to get another level of depth to that story. And it's teaching you about what needs to be included, what's important in the story, which is then transferable into your bigger story. You have to make it a bigger picture thing.
Right.
So, is there anything else you want to say before we go ahead and do the end?
I think that's it for this week.
Okay. So if you are getting stuck, and you know, maybe want some opinions from other people, maybe want, you know, just to see what's there, Holly has a, forum in, her forums. It's the open discussion. I believe we'll put a link to it in the show notes,
right.
But it's somewhere that's, you know, free. Again, you do have to have an account, because, when people post, we do, it is a free forum, but we do monitor it for people that don't follow the rules.
Right. And it's private.
Yes. Everything. Yeah. It's all private. You can join, you can post, you can talk to people, you can try to figure out your problem. So it did, you know, give it a shot. And you can come to the website, alonewithinvisiblepeople.com, and comment on today's episode. But we talked about this, and we have created a forum specifically for our podcasters. So if you are listening, or podcast listeners, so if you are listening to Alone in a Room with Invisible People, and you want to talk about any of the subjects that we've talked about in any of one of the episodes, we are going to have a forum specifically for you guys. You can, you know, if you haven't joined, it's free. Just create an account and then you can start posting. We are going to have each episode listed individually, so you can go into the episode that you had a story on and go ahead and post your opinions, your stories, your problems, whatever you have that is kind of getting you to the point where you want to talk about it. We have a place for you to talk, and it's safe. Now, it's just starting up. It's brand new. Holly does check the forums every day. I usually check the forums pretty much every day.
And moderators.
So, yes, and the moderators are in there all the time.
Right.
So we do have people there. Just, you know, give it some time, and it will definitely grow. But we wanted to give you guys a good, safe place to discuss everything, to where it kept our levels of standard and Holly's levels of standard of privacy as well.
Right.
So that is... we'll put it in the show notes. We'll also have a link to the forum in the pages, in our links, so that you can always access that. You just, you know, have to create an account to be able to talk to other people.
Right. And you do get the free flash fiction class when you create the account. That stuff's all automatic. So.
Yeah, that's automatic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Because automatic works again. Yay.
Yes. Okay, so that is it for our episode, Getting Unstuck. You can find us at aloneinaroomwithinvisiblepeople.com or alonewithinvisiblepeople.com. You can find us on socials. We've got Facebook, which is Alone in a Room with Invisible People. We have Twitter and Instagram as well, which is at AIARWIP. And you can also use the hashtag Alone with Invisible People or Alone in a Room with Invisible People. We are still offering our two ebooks. Holly's is Squig Studies. Mine is Good Bones. Holly's is Science Fiction. Mine is kind of horror, more, you know, I guess it's kind of like horror comedy. I don't know. But yeah, so if you leave us an iTunes review and you send us the information saying that you did leave it and you would like your ebooks, once we verify that you have left us a review, we will send those ebooks to you. Just go ahead and email me at show@alonewithinvisiblepeople.com and I will get those out to you once we have verified your review. Lastly, we still have our flash fiction contest. Basically, listen to our Why Write Flash Fiction episode of the podcast, and it will give you most of the details. Can't accept them all. We have had some submissions. I'm very, very excited. I know Holly is too. We would love to see your submissions.
Yes, that's it.
All right, so that is it for today's episode, and I guess we will see you on the next one.
Yeah, we'll see you next week.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
You want to write? You love words, you love fiction, but you don't know where to start, or how to middle, or where to finish. I do. I'm Holly Lyle, and I've been doing this professionally since 1991. And I know how I did what I did to go pro, and I'll be happy to show you what I've learned. Start with my free 3-week flash fiction class at hollyswritingclasses.com.